Donald J. Trump will take the oath of office tomorrow, an event that has many Democrats and progressives asking, what do we do now? Longtime activists Becky Bond and Zach Exley, two of the top advisors on volunteer mobilization for the Bernie Sanders campaign, have given that question a lot of thought, and their new book, Rules for Revolutionaries, How Big Organizing Can Change Everything, provides a clear blueprint for organizing and mobilizing people for political change in the digital age. Prior to joining the Sanders campaign, Becky Bond served as political director at Credo and is a co-founder of Credo Super PAC. Among other organizing jobs he's done, Zach Exley was a union organizer and then served as MoveOn.org's first organizing director in its 2003 campaign to prevent the war in Iraq. Their book is from Chelsea Green Publishing, and I'm very pleased it's brought Becky Bond and Zach Exley to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
You wrote your book before the election. Were you surprised by the outcome?
Yeah. I mean, we actually, in our introduction, we both suggest that, you know, Trump does have a chance, and we were a little embarrassed, you know, as everybody became more and more sure that he had no chance. We were like, oh, people are going to laugh when this book comes out, but that we thought he had a chance. But yeah, like everybody, we were surprised and horrified.
for many people, the election's outcome came as a shock. But after reading this book, I'm struck by what I see as your optimism. Is that a fair reading? Are you optimistic about our immediate political future?
Well, I think we're optimistic about the American people and optimistic about the amount of work and the amount of spirit that volunteers are willing to put into taking their democracy back. But the challenges that we have in front of us with money in politics and with leaders that are not responsive to the people, it's a big challenge. But if there's ever been a time when the people, I think, have been ready to organize themselves and be articulate about what they wanted to do once in power, I think now is that time.
Zach, didn't you give up your job to work on the Bernie campaign?
Yeah.
And moved to Vermont?
Yes. I did.
What was your job?
I was starting a new business, actually, and back in Missouri, where I live, and it was just starting to take off. But then I had to get back into this presidential campaign thing because of Bernie.
Did you think he had a reasonable shot at winning the nomination?
I'll be honest, I didn't in the beginning, but I thought, you know, it was worth it anyways because the movements that come along with these presidential campaigns sometimes, and I think that's valuable in itself. But then, a couple months before Iowa, it started. You know, he was getting so high up in the polls, and the movement was getting so big that I think all of us really thought he did have a chance.
Becky, didn't Zach talk you into quitting your long-term job at Credo to work on the Bernie campaign?
Yeah, he did. You didn't tell me back then that was how you felt.
No, how were you in contact?
So Zach and I were probably talking on the phone every day because Zach had been electrified by the crowds that were turning out for Bernie, and he decided to go to Washington, D.C. and get on the team, and he started calling me, and when I was seeing in the news about what was going on, I mean, I think I, like a lot of people, thought, Bernie represented so many things that I cared about, urgent action to address climate, really wanted to deal with income inequality, with the big solutions. And I think, like a lot of people, we looked around and I said, you know, if enough people who actually believe this stuff supported Bernie and went to work, then he could actually win, right? And so I thought, well, I'm one of those people. I better go join the campaign if they'll have me.
But he was being dismissed in the press as a can't-win long-shot candidate at the time. So I'm assuming you thought, well, we don't have much of a chance, but here's my opportunity to do certain things I've always wanted to do.
I mean, if there weren't so many people getting involved in the campaign, I thought he could win. I would not have quit my job if I didn't think that Bernie had a shot at winning. And really, you know, elections are won by turning out more voters than the other side. And I knew from my work that the most effective way, the gold standard for moving a voter to the polls, is a volunteer having an inspiring conversation with a voter in person at the door or on the phone. And with so many people willing to work for Bernie, I thought, gosh, we could actually talk to enough voters that he could win. And that's why I went to work for the campaign.
What were each of your roles in the Bernie Sanders campaign, Zach?
Well, we ran an experiment, basically, that was really kind of on the fringe of the campaign in the beginning. There's, you know, in presidential primaries, they care about those first four early states. And then there's 46 other states that the campaign typically does not care about. And so that was kind of the – that was the project that I carved out when I joined the campaign. And it was – you know, it's so important because there's hundreds of thousands of volunteers in those other states that want to participate. And so we built a program that allowed them to call into the early states and try to make a difference that way, but also organize their states for later.
And what about you, Becky?
Yeah, a lot of people think advisors, they think about policy or think about the soundbite. What Zach and I did every day was figure out how could we take all these people who wanted to volunteer and put them to work at tasks that would actually help Bernie win. And so we spent all of our time doing organizing, putting these volunteers into teams and into structures where they could actually accomplish big chunks of the campaign's national field plan.
Isn't it kind of iffy to rely on volunteers? Paid staff has a better sense of the mission, doesn't it?
Well, the thing is, we had 46 states that we were responsible for. And, you know, when you think about Iowa, they Iowa typically gets 100 or 150 staffers or 200 maybe even for a serious presidential primary or for the caucuses. But we had 46 states. So it would have taken tens of thousands of paid staff to actually run a campaign. It's not possible. So that was our challenge, and that was what we really wanted to show was possible, that there is a way to organize volunteers to make them effective.
Didn't you work on the Howard Dean campaign?
Yeah.
That had a lot of volunteers as well?
Yes, and that was a great lesson in how you can mobilize huge numbers of people and have that not add up to work that actually changes the outcome.
Your book's title, Rules for Revolutionaries, is an obvious play on the title of Saul Alinsky's book, Rules for Radicals. What's the difference between a revolutionary and a radical?
Well, we really wanted to update that classic of organizing, Rules for Radicals. In many ways, when Saul Alinsky wrote that book, and for your audience, Saul Alinsky is so influential with many of the organizers who are running community-based organizations today. It was really in a reaction to more radical movements. A lot of people were frightened by the Black Power movement and by people who call themselves communists. And Alinsky provided another way, which was to create these citizen organizations where paid organizers would go in and organize the people around sort of smaller incremental change, which was a lot less scary and also necessary. It was needed change. It was cleaning up public housing projects, or it was getting a stop sign on a street. But it really was about blunting the more radical influences of the people to make change through the kind of messy mass participation movements that have really changed our country many times. And so with as many urgent problems as we have and we're facing in this country and so little time to solve them, we wanted to go back to the kinds of mass participation movements that we had in the past.
Conservatives still invoke Alinsky's name as a pejorative.
It's kind of funny because there are all these, you know, books and shows that the right produces about how Alinsky was a communist, but he was actually an anti-communist. And it's funny that they're having classes on learning the Alinsky model, as you know, but actually, you know, what we kind of believe is that the Alinsky model has really slowed down and wound down the progressive movement over the decades.
My guests are Zach Exley and Becky Bond. Their book, Rules for Revolutionaries, How Big Organizing Can Change Everything. Becky, how has the digital age changed the rules of organizing? What's the role of technology in the revolution you're writing about?
That's a really great question. What we did in this presidential primary would not have been possible 4 years ago because of the rapid pace of the changing of technology. And there's all of these software platforms that in some ways, you know, make life kind of hard to live when you work for a company where you have to be always on. So it's not just email, but it's, you know, you have Google Apps, you have platforms like Slack where you're always chatting with your coworkers and you're working whether on vacation, whether at the office or it's the middle of the night. But in fact, these software platforms, most of which are free or extremely low cost, provide this excellent forum for getting volunteers, no matter where they live, no matter what time it is, in touch with each other and in touch with the campaign. So it allowed us to take these advances that are being used in business and basically globalizing the economy to use it to organize people to fight that.
People spend a lot of time creating, signing, and sharing online petitions for one cause or another. Are those petitions effective change agencies?
I think it's always worthwhile when someone wants to put their name on something and stand up for change. And what that often does is create a list of people that you know believes in something. But the next step has to come through, which is that you then have to be asked to do things in person to change things. You have to be asked to make a phone call, to show up at a meeting, right, to actually do something. And I think one of the advances of the Bernie campaign was that we show that if you ask people to do something big, to win something big, they're really ready to do more than just click on a button or put their name on something. They're really, or share something on Facebook. They're really ready to show up in person, to do work, and to come together to make change.
So the book is called Rules for Revolutionaries. Rule number one, Zach, is you won't get a revolution if you don't ask for one. Can you explain?
Yeah, well, that is what Bernie did, right? He said, we need a political revolution in this country. And he said, free college tuition, Medicare for all, and a bunch of other great stuff.
But didn't people react negatively to the word revolution?
Well, they didn't. That's the amazing thing. And I was always fond of the word revolution. And my friends, including a lot of progressives, would say, you can't say that. That's inflammatory. But it turns out that people really do feel like we need some serious change in this country, and revolution is a great word to reference that.
Central to the debate between Democrats during the primary season was, is a revolution even possible? Given today's rather political climate, is radical change of the sort you're proposing possible?
Well, I think so, because, you know, here's the thing. We had a revolution in this country, and through it, we got this awesome democracy. And as much as progressives complain about how we get outspent and the voting systems have problems, if we organize a powerful enough movement, we can win. The Republicans have been showing us that for decades now. And right now, they control most of the state houses, governor's houses, and all that stuff. So yes, we can use our democracy to have an electoral revolution. And that's what Bernie was egging the country on to do.
Yeah, Beck, is it just really a matter of, as you put it in the book, making the big ask?
Well, certainly if you don't ask someone to do something big, they're probably not going to do it, right?
But you have to have a plan, don't you? You're asking them to do something.
Right. Well, of course it has to make sense. Look, the people are smart. And when we talk about, you know, there's been a lot of everyone is this, everyone that thrown around. And I think for those of us who travel in elite circles or in the media, we have this sense of who the everyone is. But I think the election of Donald Trump showed us that actually, you know what, we don't have as diverse of understanding of where people in this country are and what they're thinking about. And, you know, with an election, the plan to win is to turn out more voters than the other side. And so, in a sense, it's easier to talk about these organizing theories in relationship to an election. And we were able to give people a centralized plan to win, how to contact enough voters to make Bernie viable, right? That was our centralized plan to win, and let them work on it no matter where they were. But there's lots of other organizing challenges out there where people can come up with a plan, and if a lot of people get to work on it, whether it's knocking on doors or whether it's raising enough money or whether it's convincing an elected official to do something, people are smart. They can come up with these plans, and if the plan's smart enough, people will join them and make it happen.
Many of the pundits argued that incremental change is the best strategy, but you don't agree.
I mean, incremental change is usually the only kind of change you're going to get. But people don't fight for taking that one next step. They need to know where they're going. So you climb a staircase by taking a bunch of steps up the staircase. The way to mobilize a whole nation through a political movement is to say where you're going, not to talk about that very next step. And that was Hillary Clinton's big mistake.
Because incremental change means to a lot of people politics as usual, maintaining the status quo.
Well, people are busy, and people have a lot of stuff going on in their lives, and they need to know that what you're asking them to get involved in is worth their time and worth the time that they're going to take away from their kids and their jobs and all that stuff. So you need to say, here's where we're going, and it's going to be big and beautiful.
Some people have noted that both Bernie and Trump were reaching out to the same audience and had the same kinds of responses. Do you agree?
Well, I think they both were reaching out to all Americans in some ways. They weren't assuming that they had some small constituencies that they had to turn out and that they didn't actually have to give a big message to America. And I think that a lot of politicians in the parties are making assumptions about who their base is. And I think what we learned in this election is you can't make assumptions about people. You need to talk to them. You need to find out what's going on in their lives. And then you need to propose an agenda that speaks to what the country needs.
Given that Clinton won the Democratic primary and the Republicans won the White House and both chambers of Congress, do you think that American voters have an appetite for a big ask or for a revolutionary change?
Well, I do think so because – and I think that actually if you look at how the Republicans have come to power in this way, if you look at the way they organize at a grassroots local level, you know, this Christian conservative movement is – it is a big ask, and it's this all-encompassing movement. It's actually very radical when you look at how they're organizing on a local level.
Is that what you're calling big organizing?
I think they do. I think if you look at the history of the Christian right organizing over the last several decades, I think it does share a lot of the elements that we're talking about with big organizing. You know, they had a big vision for really changing the country, for organizing millions of people for really big goals. They, you know, in their meetings, in their books, in their organizing, they talked about where they wanted to be 50 years from where they started. They said, here's where we want to be 50 years from now. And they planned accordingly. And they built infrastructure. And they had a long-term view. And we have not seen that on the left or with the Democrats.
But it's interesting that after Barack Obama won his first election, everybody talked about how brilliant his organization had been and how it was changing the way political campaigns would be run. And now we're talking about the Democrats falling behind.
Yeah, well, I mean, the president really shut down his campaign organization once he was elected into office. And I think that people went home and thought that the president could handle everything, that he had it. And they went back to their lives. And I think what we learned then is that you have to stay engaged, that you can't count on the politicians, given how much influence money has on the system, to fall through unless the people are there to hold them accountable. And, you know, I want to say I do think that the people voted for really radical change in this election. I think that President-elect Trump is promising very radical things. He put the CEO of Exxon not in charge of the EPA, but in charge of our whole foreign policy. Like, that's incredibly radical. And so, you know, the problem was that the Democrats didn't offer an alternative that promised enough change, and the people rolled the dice on Donald Trump, and now we're living with the consequences.
Yeah.
My guests are Becky Bond and Zach Exley. Their book, Rules for Revolutionaries, How Big Organizing Can Change Everything. And the title suggests that big organizing can change everything. Did your big organizing for the Bernie campaign change American politics, do you think?
Well, I think every one of these big movement presidential campaigns does change American politics over the past few cycles. You know, if you look at the Dean campaign, the Obama campaign, and the Bernie campaign, a lot of new stuff was discovered and invented, and the people that participate, you know, retain that experience. And, you know, we built on stuff that was developed by the Obama campaign. The problem with this presidential campaign phenomena is that it's contained in the campaign, and as soon as the campaign is over, the movement dissipates. And, you know, and that's as opposed to what we were just talking about with the right, and it's a much more broad, you know, and deeply rooted movement.
Well, the Dean campaign came to an end with that famous scream.
Well, it came to an end
by
losing Iowa.
But Trump also had a whole bunch of things that would have been the equivalent of that big scream.
But this is the thing. It wasn't the scream. Dean came in fourth in Iowa. And, when you know, as the Clintons said, there's only three tickets out of Iowa. So they, you know, the Dean campaign made a mistake in that it did not get organized in Iowa. That was a mistake that the Obama campaign corrected. But you're making a great point, which is why wasn't Trump disqualified? And the way, you know, by all of the horrible things that came out, the way I understand that is that he did disqualify himself over and over and over again, but voters were so angry about the status quo, and especially in those three states that gave him the presidency, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, those people experienced their means of making a living be dismantled over several decades. And Clinton's brand was all over that dismantling. And so enough people said, I don't care if this guy is the devil, I'm going to vote for him because I'm so mad.
Hillary's also been faulted for not campaigning in Michigan, Wisconsin,
and she didn't go to a single UAW hall in Michigan during the campaign, which is almost impossible to do if you know Michigan.
If you had been advising her, would you have said you got to go there?
I think if anybody who was looking at the data and was at all in touch with what was going on with the American people, they would say, you got to get to Michigan, you got to get to Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, and you got to talk to those people about what happened to their means of making a living and what you're going to do about it.
Becky, what is distributed organizing?
Well, it's really interesting. On a lot of campaigns, people would call what Zach and I do as digital organizing. And, you know, that sort of conveys, you know, pictures of people, you know, at their laptops on Facebook, you know, sitting in some headquarters. And you know, for us, we weren't trying to get people to do things online. We were just using digital tools to get them to do things in the real world. And so it's sort of like when organizers started using the telephone instead of just having to go to someone's house. You didn't call them telephone organizers. So the idea about distributed organizing was really to actually bring what we do with technology back into the realm of the kind of field organizing that these campaigns are based on, but also to suggest that, you know, we can actually now, with the new technology we have, we can get a lot of stuff going in a lot of places and not have to be there all at once. And that's the distributed nature of the campaign that was so powerful and also so scalable. And that's a new thing in presidential politics.
And it relies on volunteers, as the earlier versions relied on volunteers. Is it important to still have people go door to door?
Absolutely. You know, having these conversations, and this comes back to Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and sort of how the Clinton campaign wasn't connecting with voters. They made a decision not to run the large scale kind of canvasses where volunteers go door to door and they're bringing data back into headquarters. So there's a feedback loop between the voters and the campaign. And not only is it make the most impact on a voter to talk to them in person, they're more likely to go to vote, you're more likely to change their mind, but it also lets the campaign actually have a day by day, a very visceral connection to what's going on in the country outside of their headquarters. And our politicians are really lacking that today, which I think is how so many people got surprised.
Has the DNC asked you about your successes organizing all of those volunteers?
The DNC? I don't know. What's even going on at the DNC right now? I don't know.
I think
I just imagine a bunch of zombies walking around in the hallways.
It needs to choose ahead before it can even start moving forward.
You know, this is a good suggestion. We should send them a box of books because I think they're waiting. They have a leadership fight right now, and so I think a lot of things are on pause there. So I think that maybe they have time to do some reading.
We just got a big bulk order for our book by a state Democratic Party. I don't know if we should call out what state, but it. So we would.
One way or the other?
What do you mean? You mean in the election?
Yes.
No, it's in a red state. It's a red state. Yes, and so they ordered a bulk order of our book. So yes, any state parties out there, or the DNC? Yes, we'll ship you crates of the book.
A listener asks: is revolution the right word? It's been 100 years since the Russian Revolution. This sounds more like using democracy to achieve goals.
That's right. What we're talking about is a political revolution. While we still have our democracy, we want to use it to change who's in power so we can make the policy changes that we need. But let's be honest, you know, we're losing, you know, some of our democracy. It's not just the fact that we've lost the National Voting Rights Act in many ways, but we literally have places like Detroit or Puerto Rico where the bankers have bankrupted, you know, the citizenry, and then they've literally forced leadership, like political leadership. They're not run by elected officials anymore. And I think we have to be aware, if we don't have a political revolution, we may have to have a real one, or else we're going to lose our country.
Yeah, but so let's have a political one instead.
Rule number 20, is get ready for the counter-revolution to include your friends.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when you want big change, you know, that's scary to a lot of people, even people, you know, that may agree with you about what needs to happen. And, you know, there's so many people that said for Bernie, I agree with Bernie on the issues, but he can never win. And that's why they supported Clinton. And I think that if people, you know, need to understand that, you know, that they could be held back by people that are trying to tell them, hey, you're going to hurt the Clinton campaign, you shouldn't push for Bernie. But in reality, we showed it was possible for Bernie to win the primary. And had we started earlier and had fewer people been afraid to join the campaign that they agreed with, it could have been a different outcome.
One of the evaluations of the 2016 general election is that the white working class and the Rust Belt abandoned the Democratic Party and voted for Trump. Has the Democratic Party lost the working class vote for good?
Well, we got to
keep... Is this the new normal?
The thing is, Trump was the most unpopular presidential candidate ever, right? And it's just that Hillary Clinton was the second most unpopular. And like we were talking about, in those Rust Belt states, people were just so mad about their means of making a living being dismantled. You know, he had a message that got a few of those people to come out. So yes, the way, you know, the Democratic Party establishment lost those workers. I don't think it's just the white working class, though. You know, their turnout among working class people was lower for Hillary than for Obama across the board, across every ethnicity, every gender. It was lower for Hillary. And so, yeah. And the crazy thing is that Trump, as a Republican, you know, went completely against Republican Party policies and Republican ideology with his trade policy, with his industrial policy, and just about everything he said about economics. So if that's not a sign to the Democrats, you know, that this guy comes off of reality television and wins the presidency with what used to be the Democrats' economic message, if that's not a sign to the Democrats that they lost the working class, not just the white working class, that they lost the working class and that they can get it back just by talking about how to rebuild people's means of making a living, if that's not a sign, then I don't know what is. But we'll see if they get that message.
Bernie seemed to be rather reluctant to go very hard after Hillary during the campaign. Was that something that trickled down to the staff? And then the volunteers?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Bernie was very clear to the staff that he didn't want anyone saying anything negative about Secretary Clinton. And in fact, we in our public meetings, we always referred to Bernie's fight against the billionaire-backed candidates, right? And so what we were doing is we were organizing people around a set of political ideals. And, you know, when we went to these, Zach and I traveled the country constantly meeting with volunteers and helping them set up these volunteer organizations. And whenever we met with them, we just said, we're not talking about the other candidates, what they're doing. We're talking about how to get to work to fight for the things that we believe in. And the campaign on the ground, as opposed to on Facebook, was very positive about the issues and what we were fighting for, not what we were fighting against.
Are you amused at all that Goldman Sachs, which was criticized on both sides, now is kind of dominate the new cabinet?
It's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. You know, it's
a requirement for membership in the cabinet you have to be from Goldman.
Or a billionaire. You have to be one of the two. Or both.
Well, better if you're both. You know, yeah.
Thanks to both of you, Becky Bond and Zach Exley. Their book is Rules for Revolutionaries, How Big Organizing Can Change Everything. It is published by Chelsea Green.
Thank you.
Thank you.